Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A secret whistleblower complaint from a U.S. intelligence official has set the Capitol on knife's edge. It reportedly involves President Trump, Ukraine, and a whole lot of unknowns. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff says he's prepared to sue to get answers.
This shows how someone is trying to manipulate the system to keep information about an urgent matter from the Congress.
The House Judiciary Committee kicks off a hearing into possible articles of impeachment against Trump. His former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, sought to stonewall Chairman Jerry Nadler's inquiry.
But I simply ask you, is it correct that as reported in the Mueller report on June 19th, 2017, you met alone in the Oval Office with the president?
Could you read the exact language of the report, sir? I don't have it available to me.
I don't think I need to do that, and I have limited time.
And the union representing American auto workers calls a strike against General Motors. Union members rallied in Kansas City, among other places.
Worker power! Worker power! When I say union, you say power! Union power! Union power! When I say
Join us. There's new fronts in the pitched battle between the Trump administration and Democrats on Capitol Hill. How do you land? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. With us from Washington, D.C., Karen Tumulty, columnist for The Washington Post who covers national politics. Karen, thanks for joining us at the end of another busy week.
Oh, yes. Thanks. Great to be here.
Also with us from Washington, Margaret Tolive. She's politics and White House editor for Axios. Margaret, congrats on the new job and great to have you with us once more as well.
Thanks, David. Hi.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, OnPoint News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Karen, and Margaret.
So we heard at the top of this intro from the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. Karen Tumulty, tell us a little bit more about what we've learned from your paper, among other places, about this whistleblower's complaint and why we should care.
Well, this whistleblower's complaint apparently deals with a conversation between the president of the United States and the leader of Ukraine. And, you know, there are a lot of dots out there that need to be connected. But the suggestion is that the president may possibly have been pressuring Ukraine to open an investigation against former Vice President Joe Biden and his son, which it would be a very serious, a very serious issue if it were true. And so the Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, is in a very difficult spot here because acting on advice of his legal counsel, he is not turning over this whistleblower complaint to the Congress, to Adam Schiff and the Intelligence Committee, so that we can really see what exactly is being alleged here.
Margaret Tolive, there are a couple of things that I think are worth a little bit unpacking. Trump spoke with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, who's a political newcomer elected last May, I guess shortly before the complaint was filed, according to the Post and other places. Trump had spoken with Zelensky, and there was the question of whether, among other things, that money would be released to Ukraine only if they embarked on this investigation of the Bidens, right? And so there's a question of whether this was an improper use of federal funds. Why wouldn't a whistleblower, theoretically such folks are protected from interference, and why wouldn't an inspector general, theoretically some people operate with real independence, be able to converse with senior figures on an intelligence committee who presumably have some kind of security clearance?
Right. So we're all learning very quickly about what the law allows and doesn't allow in these sort of things. This is like, one of these things where you cover politics forever, but you realize you didn't really know what levers the IG has when it involves classified information and national intelligence. Our understanding at this point is that we actually think that the IG does have several levers and does have the capacity to go talk to people in the House of Representatives or the Senate, in theory, who have the ability to who are kind of cleared at that level that they can receive classified information. The question is whether the director of national intelligence themselves can go ahead and forward those complaints or forward those discussions if it's not been cleared by the attorney general. So I think there are some differences about what the head of DNI can do and what the IG can do, or at least the perception about what those two can do. And that has a lot to do with why we see so much largely behind the scenes in Congress. It's interesting because we've seen a very public messaging by Democrats, by a couple of Democrats, including Adam Schiff and including Senator Chris Murphy so far, in terms of sort of disclosing outrage or suspicions to the public. But in reality, the folks who are trying to get to the bottom of this, most of those substantive discussions are going to have to happen behind closed doors and in a non-public space because they it seems that they deal with information that's classified.
Margaret, I assume you saw some of the president's sometime lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on CNN last
yeah.
night,
yes.
An exchange with Chris Cuomo in it, which he once angrily denounced the idea that the president had done this and then seemingly confirmed that he had been involved in pressuring them to do just that.
Like 5 seconds later in the same breath, yeah.
Pretty yes. much. What did we learn or not learn in that exchange?
I got to tell you, if I had to bank on it, I'm not sure I'd take any of it to the bank. It was not the most forthcoming interview, although it did seem like he's like, yeah, I wouldn't talk to them. But what do we learn? It's kind of underscored what we already knew, that Rudy Giuliani has been involved in trying to have discussions with the Ukrainians and that he's operating in this kind of murky space where he's not representing the U.S. government, but he is acting as at least a friend of and sometimes a lawyer of the president, but it's not clear in what capacity, because why would the president's personal dealings with the Ukrainians or 2020 have any relevance or propriety to an investigation into U.S. national security or the previous administration? So there are just so many layers to this. And I just want to take a step back and say that based on the early reporting so far, these concerns about the Ukraine are a piece of this, but not the only piece of this, and that it appears that there may be concerns about more than one of the president's conversations with more than one foreign leader. So I think there's a lot that's going to come out in the coming days, and that for all of us who are covering it, it's really important to try to get to the bottom of it, but also to be really cautious in understanding what we're reporting as we go, because this deals with really sensitive issues.
And we have seen some some commentary from people like Jack Goldsmith, a former Bush administration official in the on legal matters, who nonetheless has been a critic of executive authority, who say, you know, the president's given a lot of latitude in dealing with foreign leaders and intelligence matters, and for good reason. Jack Beatty, I want to turn now to the question of another point of flashpoint between Congress, Democrats on Congress, and the Trump administration. The House Judiciary Committee kicked off a hearing Tuesday on the question of whether President Trump's actions warrant impeachment, although they're very tentative about calling it impeachment hearings. First up was former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski. The majority's counsel, legal counsel that is, Barry Burke, pressed Lewandowski on an MSNBC interview from May of this year. In that interview, Lewandowski claimed that President Trump did not ask him to, quote, get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice in any way, shape, or form ever. Jeff Sessions, of course, at that time had been attorney general. Burke noted that the facts prove otherwise.
The question is, are you a truth teller in that interview?
I'm a truth teller every time I stand before Congress or a committee of jurisdiction and raise my hand and swear to God under oath.
My question, sir, is when you said the president never asked you to get involved with Mr. Sessions.
I have no obligation to have a candid conversation with the media whatsoever, just like they have no obligation to cover me honestly, and they do it inaccurately all the time.
So you're admitting that on national television you were lying there.
What I'm saying is they have been inaccurate on many occasions, and perhaps I was inaccurate at that time.
Jack Beatty, Democrats got a lot of heat for sort of, you know, just doing partisan fencing for much of that hearing. What did we learn from that exchange of the president's former top campaign official and the legal counsel to the committee?
Well, as a resident of New Hampshire, I learned that a putative candidate for the Senate here, running against Gene Shaheen next year, Corey Lewandowski, lies when he's not under oath. That's not going to help him, it seems to me, win that office. It'll certainly it'll certainly fire up that minority of voters, let's hope, in New Hampshire who don't really care about the truth. You know, just the character of this contumacious character here, he's really something. When you look back on him, he was charged with battery for grabbing a reporter in 2016. He was charged with bringing a gun into a congressional building some years ago. Last year, he threatened a neighbor with a baseball bat. This is the character of the sort of person the president, has around him. And we learned from that Barry Burke colloquy, very skillful questioning, that when Lewandowski, when the White House called him in and asked him to take this message to Sessions, which message, basically saying deep six this inquiry into me would be looks like an obstruction of justice, the White House had dangled a job before him to give him a little incentive there. We mm-hmm. also learned that when he testified to the Mueller on the Mueller probe, he asked for immunity and took the Fifth and asked for immunity. Why would he ask for immunity unless he had done something wrong? That's his reading of it, by the way. They quoted Burke quoted him saying, "If you take the Fifth, you've done something wrong." So he made a shambles of most of the Democrats through the day, but Burke really, I think, got some valuable things out of him in that.
Karen Tumulty, before we take our first break, briefly, give me 30 seconds on this. Democrats have obviously been divided on the wisdom of embarking on this. As a scene setter, is this a promising thing for those who would push harder on Trump on the question of impeachment?
Well, I hope they've learned a few things from it. And one is that they are much better if they leave the questioning not to politicians but to the lawyers, who are good at – much better than politicians sort of preening for the cameras. The second thing is that I wonder about people in our business. I'm putting Corey Lewandowski on the air now that he has declared publicly that he doesn't tell the truth.
Perfectly happy to lie. Doesn't have to swear an oath to talk to us. We're talking about the week in news. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about Trump's new national security advisor and the role of the debate over Iran. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're going behind the headlines of the week's top news stories. You can join our conversation, follow us on Twitter, and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour remain Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Margaret Tolliva of Axios, and On Point's own Jack Beattie. I want to start, I guess, with the president's new national security advisor. Out with the old, in with the new. On Wednesday in Los Angeles, the president introduced his new national security advisor, a gentleman by the name of Robert O'Brien.
Robert's been fantastic. We know each other well.
It's a privilege to serve with the president, and we look forward to another year and a half of peace through strength. We've had tremendous foreign policy successes under President Trump's leadership. I expect those to continue. We've got a number of challenges, but there's a great team in place with Secretary Pompeo and Secretary Esper, Secretary Mnuchin, and others. I look forward to working with them and working with the president to keep America safe.
The president said he knows Robert O'Brien well. Margaret Tolliff, we certainly knew something of John Bolton, he of the walrus mustache and the hawkish national security views. What do we know about Robert O'Brien?
We know that Robert O'Brien has – the president knows him well from the last couple of years, but that Robert O'Brien came to this path through a really different path than a lot of national security advisors. He was a lawyer who had his own firm in Los Angeles. He'd been on this kind of hostage envoy job for the last couple of years. And in that capacity, the president really came to like him because he understood how to work with the president's personality and because he's had some successes. And because when the president was like, go be at the ASAP Rocky thing, he was like, okay, I'm on the case. So he gets on well with the president. In some reports, you've seen him described as Bolton Light. But the fact of the matter
is, what does that mean?
Well, that he's kind of a sort of semi-hawkish conservative Republican, but that he's not looking to start interventions maybe as aggressively as Bolton would be. But I think we don't really know until we see him in action. We do know that he's widely expected to be less antagonistic with the president, that his style so far of working with the president is to kind of understand how to bring the president over to his side or to make sure that the president's trusting him to give him a path to act. And if that holds, if that's successful, which is like the model of a hostage negotiator, right? If you're a hostage negotiator, you're trying to get the guy who's holding everyone else captive to kind of trust you and meet you in the middle.
And out of curiosity, in this particular analogy, who's the hostage and who's the captor here?
As I was talking, I could see what was happening, and I thought I'd try to artfully weave around it and let the listeners form their own conclusions. But I think there may be something to that. You know, I talked to a number of Republicans this week kind of across the partisan – across the Republican partisan spectrum, kind of from the never-Trumpers to the always-Trumpers and somewhere in between. And uniformly, they all were very interested in the idea of O'Brien. They thought, given the choices that were probably at hand, O'Brien was a pretty good pick. But he doesn't have a lot of that traditional national security experience. And I think, you know, I think many Democrats have given up on the idea that it makes really any difference who the national security advisor is, because Trump is going to pursue the policies he wants to pursue. And it's going to be the national security advisor's job to either try to hold him back if they feel like it's unwise, or to try to facilitate what he has announced often by Twitter that he's going to be doing.
Karen Tumulty, you know, sometimes it's it is a risk to divine overarching strategy, it seems to me, with this with most administrations, but particularly this one, right? It seems to be more of a lurching, impulsive thing. And at the same time, you know, Bolton was an aggressive guy. And yet this president, who is clearly, you know, pulling people in his direction, nonetheless talks incredibly boldly and then does not seem to want to do enormous commitments of American firepower. What can we divine in terms of attitudinally where this administration is on foreign policy, if there's a coherent way to capture its approach? Karen? We may have lost Karen Tumulty. Let me go to our own Jack Beadie.
One comment that the president made.
I'm sorry, there she...
short. I thought one comment that the president.
I'm going to turn to Jack Beadie for a moment. We'll work and bring the wonderful Karen Tumulty back to us. Jack, what do you make of that? You know, what philosophical direction can you see in how the president deploys foreign policy?
I think it's called election 2020. That's the overriding imperative. And I think in this current standoff with Iran, the Iranians have made the sound calculation that the president will not, unless absolutely forced to the wall, commit the use of force. And because now the Iranians have put us on notice that not only can they involve us in a war, which would hurt the president politically, but they can affect world energy prices and eventually, although nothing like the lines of the 70s, can affect gas prices here in the U.S. In the meantime, by leading us to the edge of war and then continually backing off at these Iranian provocations, the president fritters away American credibility. It's already been weakened by his propensity to lie, exaggerate, tell tales out of school. But now it's being frittered away by, as you say, these bombastic threats followed by retreats. And we saw that pattern this week. His Secretary of State says it was an act of war. The president puts the brakes on that and, well, yes, but we need to talk. And he seems willing to talk. The Iranians say, no, we're not willing to talk. And by the way, we're ready for all-out war.
Yeah, please hop in.
I just wanted to say that as we're talking about O'Brien and how he fits into all of this, I think some of his ties to other Republicans who are still very involved in public office is important to remember. He's got ties to Mitt Romney and Romney's folks, to the George W. Bush administration, to Republicans across the U.S. like Scott Walker. And all of those, I think, are levers that he has to help him communicate with the president indirectly as well as directly. And also the fact that he comes sort of, at least a piece of him, from Romney world and was not originally a Trump supporter, I think is important in understanding not only that he really has been able to win over Donald Trump's trust to some degree, because Trump is not always inclined to embrace people who did not originally embrace him. But it does show that he has a sense of politics that he brings to this job. Whether he will be able to wield that effectively, we don't know. The previous national security advisors have not had as much luck as they wanted to. But I think perhaps because of the different skills he brings to the table, he has some tools that he can try to use to help have the president consider different points of view, at least.
Senator Romney, obviously someone not only an occasional Trump critic, but also someone seen as a globalist and interested in the international order. We have a call now related to this topic, I think, from Des Moines, Iowa. Jeffrey, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, the president has a number of times talked about using nuclear weapons against Iran when he talks about ending Iran as we know it, or the ultimate weapon. And I sort of understand that U.S. media is caught up in this spectacle over this person over sort of reasonable sanity. But I wonder about the effect on the Persian people, you know, 82 million people, where you have a president who's threatening to possibly kill millions, possibly tens of millions of people. I mean, we might not really think that's newsworthy or interesting here, because like I said, we're caught up in this spectacle over sanity. But what might this, how might this affect the Iranians and the people of Iran?
Thanks for that call, Jeffrey. Iranians, many of whom are very sympathetic and interested in the West and building better ties with the U.S. Here's what Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, said yesterday. He had said, "We won't blink before defending the country's territory." Zarif spoke in an interview with CNN's Nick Patton Walsh.
What would be the consequence of an American or a Saudi military strike on Iran now?
An all-out war.
You make a very serious statement there, sir.
Well, I make a very serious statement about defending our country. I'm making a very serious statement that we don't want war. We don't want to engage in a military confrontation. We believe that a military confrontation based on deception is awful. We'll have a lot of casualties.
So Karen Tumulty, our caller Jeffrey, points out the rhetoric from the president talking about the ultimate weapon. Iran's foreign minister says we won't blink, that it would be an all-out war if there were any American or Saudi strikes on Iran. How much should we pay attention to the rhetoric here, and how much should we pay attention to the actual actions that occur?
Well, the history would suggest that the actions don't live up to the rhetoric. I mean, going back to fire and fury with North Korea, but our allies in the Middle East, and particularly the oil-producing countries, I think are probably questioning the degree to which the United States is continuing its, you know, this long-standing agreement that we would sort of protect the oil-producing facilities because they are so important to the world economy. And the whole problem here, I think, is just essentially, you know, conducting foreign policy by tweet rather than by the sorts of processes that that we are used to.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
go ahead, Margaret.
The population of Iran is like 82 million people, like a huge part among all the other reasons why the U.S. posture would not be inclined to proceed military with Iran. Like, that's one of them. You can't just any kind of military action in a country that involves 82 million people is a completely different ballgame. And when you look at the other countries in the region, like Syria's got like, I don't know, 18 million people. I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq, even Saudi, these are countries with maybe 30 million people. Iran is a huge country with highly developed systems and military and response levers and, proxies. And there are a million reasons why the U.S. does not want to hyper-engage in this either. The caller who asked about the psychological impact on the Iranian people, I think probably the U.S. like sanctions and the squeeze it's put on the Iranian economy are having the biggest impact. And that's the lever that lawmakers and the administrations from both parties had always hoped would be the main test for whether or not the country would change its behavior. And so far, it hasn't.
You know, you talk about Iran, you think of a country with a smaller population like Afghanistan. It didn't work out so great for us there either. I want to turn now to things that got white hot at the top of the week over the question of a Supreme Court justice and his behavior in college. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had harsh words on Capitol Hill, I believe back on Tuesday, over fresh accusation of misconduct against future Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Harsh words, that is, for the two reporters for the New York Times involved in that coverage. As an editor's note acknowledged, the paper's initial excerpt from their book omitted a key contextual detail that cut against the allegation.
They ought to be embarrassed. And professionally, I think all of you ought to feel badly about this as well. And this was the New York Times, not some occasionally read blog post somewhere.
Margaret Tolliver, this was the New York Times. It was an excerpt of a book by Kate Kelly and Robin Pugerman. And their book basically included bolstered the account of a woman who had essentially accused the future justice of, forgive me, folks, if your kid's listening, but basically putting a penis in her face during a party at which a number of students were intoxicated. They provided more, have to suggest that was credible as an accusation, and brought in another accusation in which another student during another party put Kavanaugh's penis in her hand, much against her interest. This student, however, had said that she had not remembered this incident, didn't want to talk about it, told friends she had no recollection of it from the time, which would have cut against the accusation to at least a degree, although many people, including the student, were said to have been intoxicated during that event. What are we to make of the revelations about the justice and about the way in which the press handled it?
Those are two pretty loaded questions. I mean, I think the Times has sort of extensively tried to deconstruct what happened and explaining the issues around the coverage. And I definitely encourage everyone who's interested in that to read some of those details. But I think what it says about the Supreme Court and the politics around this today is that there's still a tremendous amount of interest in litigating this among a lot of Americans, still a lot of Americans who think that he should not have been confirmed, and a lot of Americans on the other side of the argument whose minds were made up, before Christine Blasey Ford ever testified, that the accusations against him were ridiculous and shouldn't be part of the discussions. And so there remains this divide about whether he should be on the Supreme Court, but that does not extend to the only place where it actually matters in terms of Brett Kavanaugh's future and the future of the court, which is, you know, the Congress and the Senate. There is a mechanism in theory to remove a Supreme Court justice. It is impeachment, and there is no movement, no actual movement or math under the current setup of the Senate that suggests that there's a path or an inclination for that to happen.
Karen Tumulty, it struck me that Democrats, as Margaret suggested, you know, were seizing on this, that some are saying that Kavanaugh must have perjured himself in talking about his college days in that inquiry, wanted to, in a sense, relitigate it. But that Republicans saw this as good politics, too, that they could feed the anger of the base, particularly the Trump base, over both the media and the sense that somehow liberals simply aren't going to give conservatives a fair deal.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we also saw we saw four of the Democratic presidential contenders within hours of this New York Times report coming out, rushing out to call for impeachment. I think this is actually something Republicans, this is a fight, this is a subject Republicans would like to have people reminded of, and not just for stirring up their base, although it does. I had done a column earlier this week where I looked, for instance, at some research that was done by a Democratic organization called Galvanize USA, where they surveyed white non-college educated women. This is a very, very crucial constituency in this next election because they went heavily to Donald Trump in 2016. And if you look at the polling now, they are the ones who are moving to the other side. They've really been essentially falling off the Trump train.
But and I think that in your column, you indicate in some ways that they think maybe they can get women back who are concerned about how their brothers and sons, husbands might be accused as well in such circumstance. I'm cutting you off only because we've got to take a very quick break as we dive into this week's news. You can join us as you're thinking about the week's issues. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, photos and videos emerged depicting Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in brownface and blackface in several separate incidents. He's apologized. Trudeau's image as a leading global progressive has, however, taken a hit in the heat of a re-election campaign. Gunmaker Colt suspends production of the popular AR-15 rifle for civilians. Talks between the White House and Congress, inspired by a series of mass shootings, continue without resolution. Drugmaker Purdue Pharma files for bankruptcy. The company faces thousands of lawsuits over its role in the national opioid crisis. And we've been talking a little bit earlier this hour about Iran. The Hill is reporting that the president says he's going to be sanctioning Iran's national bank. We'll be following all of these stories and more in coming days. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour remain Margaret Tolliv of Axios, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and On Point's own Jack Beatty. Getting a little bit more about the Iran sanctions the sanctions on the Iranian bank. Trump made the comments to reporters, we are told, during an Oval Office meeting with the Australian Premier, that Scott Morrison. The announcement comes just a couple days after he had instructed the Treasury Department to increase sanctions on Iran following attacks on two oil facilities in Saudi Arabia that the U.S. and Saudi have blamed on the Iranians. I want to turn a little bit to the labor movement, a strike by the UAW, the United Auto Workers, against General Motors. Margaret Tolliv, tell us about the moment we're in. What does this mean?
Well, it is a big moment. We're about a decade out from the auto bailout. Remember that. And what is going on here is it's just like the biggest strike like this in a really long time. It's a test for the United Auto Workers, which has been facing sort of declining membership, dissenting membership. It's a test for Mary Barra at the helm of GM. It is a test for the fate of workers across the U.S., across other car makers in the auto industry. And so that's, I think, why you've seen this sort of prolonged activity, which has a big cost, something like $50 million or up per day in profits. According to analysts, this is affecting dozens of plants, more than two dozen plants across the United States. When's it going to end? How's it going to end? Is it going to help the workers in the end? And then finally, there is sort of a Trump factor to this, too, because he has been popular among many unionized auto workers. And he has sought in his approach to China, to tariffs, to trade, and his promises to bring back shuttered factories. He has made a promise to these people, and how these people feel they have fared come election time, this time about a year from now, could have a major impact on who the next president is.
Jack Beatty, you know, the tale of the labor movement, as we've heard on our program and elsewhere, has been one of certain kinds of decline. You know, we've seen a unionization in newsrooms in the last couple of years, but not in a ton of other industries. Is the UAW strong enough? Is the labor movement still strong enough to make a difference, to force certain kinds of concessions in a tight labor market at this moment in our economy?
Well, one thing has changed, and that is public support for unions. It's at a 50-year high now. It's over 60%. So there is that. There is a sort of context that is new. However, when you look at the size of the UAW, for that matter, the size of GM relative to what it was after World War II, when a series of strikes created what was called the Treaty of Detroit, which essentially established the pattern bargaining for the auto industry and ever another large industries, which pattern bargaining essentially helped to create the middle class in America. The union isn't powerful enough to do that all by itself. But its complaints, the kinds of things it is bringing up, I think have resonance that could even increase support for it. I mean, it wants the its demands are twofold. It wants the companies to keep open plants in Maryland, Ohio, and Michigan. It plans to close, and in at least a couple of those cases, to send abroad. And the second thing, it wants to bring up the temporary workers who are being paid about half of what the regular workers get, to bring their salaries up so that when you're working on the line, you're all being paid the same amount. There's a sort of basic fairness about that. Meanwhile, GM, with a $35 billion profit in the last 3 years, with its president, Mary Barra, earning 281 times the average pay of the average GM worker, it's hard to feel great sympathy for GM on the face of, with the face of those statistics. So it fits into a context of public sector union striking and teachers striking and fast food workers, and maybe it's a sign of the times that that along with these other movements can revive the American labor movement.
Turn now from auto workers to auto emissions policies. California had set a compact with four manufacturers, Volkswagen, BMW, Ford, and Honda, GM not among them, to agree to set much higher emissions targets than the federal government had done. This week, President Trump announced his administration would revoke California's authority to set its own fuel emission standards. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom responded at a press conference in Sacramento on Wednesday.
Pure politics, and politics that could have profound consequences, not just in terms of the air we breathe in the state of California, and addressing the fact we still lead the nation in air pollution. Seven of the top 10 cities, most polluted cities in America, are in our state. That's why this is so important, but will impact the rest of the country and in closing the rest of the world.
Now, Karen Tumulty, California's attorney general has said he intends to challenge this in court. This setup's a pretty lengthy legal battle, and not simply decided by the president's announcement that he would revoke this. This is part of our, I guess, federalist system. You have states and federal authorities in such matters. How important is this battle over environmental policy?
Oh, it's huge. And because of the size of California, because of the size of its market, it really has been a de facto driver of so many of these environmental policies. And there is a real kind of contradiction here in the Republicans' supposed, you know, fealty to the 10th Amendment and how, you know, government should be as local to people as possible, and these sorts of policies on the part of the Trump administration. There is also a real, just in general, hostility, it seems, between President Trump and the entire blue state of California. I mean, he very often uses California as his, you know, example of any kind of policy that he doesn't like, whether it's environmental policies or you know, how homeless people are dealt with or whatever. I mean, he loves to use California as his foil.
It's sort of like been a kind of scene. I mean, look, California is my home state. It seems to see itself as an oasis during a Trumpian era, right, where policies and the outlook is being performed in a different way.
And I think this also does speak to the extraordinarily large role that we see these state attorneys general playing in so many of these disputes with the Trump administration.
Margaret Taleb, you know, Axios really is interested in this intersection between business and politics. One of the things that strikes me is how interesting it is, you know, California really ramped up its regulations about how high, you know, essentially how many miles per gallon you can get, which is the idea is to reduce the carbon footprint from the emissions of cars. And you had these major manufacturers buying in, saying, yeah,
yes,
we want into
yes.
this market. We want to strike a deal with the state. We want certainty in what's going to be ahead for us in a way that will probably set the standard for the nation at large. Talk to me a little bit about that compact and the way in which the federal intervention affects that.
Yeah, I mean, it is really interesting, and you have seen some car executives sort of step in and say, hey, we are not objecting to what California's trying to do here. You don't need to do this for us. But I think if you take a step back, President Trump, as we know, has sought to undo like a lot of the orders and maneuvers and pacts of the Obama administration, and one of those was the Paris climate talks. And what we saw in the wake of President Trump's efforts was a coalition of kind of state and city leaders and private business say they were going to try to basically stitch it, like MacGyver it together themselves, right? And I think you can look at this as part of a piece of that. I used to cover California politics. I lived in California for many years. And like everything that has come to be normal in the U.S. now, like front-loading washing machines or the kind of light bulbs that like used to look really wonky and now they look pretty normal. That all was happening in California before it was happening anywhere else. California is a national testing ground for this stuff. And the people who don't like that in California say it makes everything more expensive. But it is kind of California is larger than many countries' economies. It's a major economy and it has the ability to be sort of quasi-contained testing ground for this. So the political reality of this is that this is going to be a campaign issue for both Trump and for the Democrats. Because this is getting challenged in court, it's entirely probable that there's not going to be a resolution to this until after the 2020 election. If President Trump is not reelected, then this all becomes a moot point. And if he is, there's just going to be this pileup of things that we're going to find out the answers to, you know, sometime in 2021. And this is probably one of them. But what you're going to see in the longer term, irrespective, at least until there's a ruling on all of this, is that you're going to see California continue to have these discussions with industries and major businesses about kind of globalism in the future and what positioning the United States and some of these companies want to have. And that's, you know, the president's going to try to fight it legally, but there's a lot of experts who think he's going to have a very difficult road on this one, on this test case that he's trying now with California. And I think to Karen's point earlier, when like in the same breath, basically, as he's doing this, he's saying he's going to slap EPA fines on San Francisco for homeless related pollution, then you can sort of see the narrative here.
Jack Beatty today also marks a sort of moment of movement, shall we say, a point at which people are demonstrating, going on a strike, if you like, to call attention to global climate matters. We'll actually be devoting an hour. I'll be hosting the first hour on Monday on this very issue, talking with people involved, youth activists, talking with some folks involved in figuring out ways to both mitigate and accommodate human life in a world that's going to be changed so much by our change in the global climate. At the same time, Jack, I'm interested in your take on what this kind of public attention, what this pressure does, if anything, in your mind, to shift the opinions and the emphases of policymakers in terms of addressing global climate change.
Well, first of all, the scale of it, 4,600 events in 139 countries. That's a worldwide event. And its motto, its inspiriting slogan, I think, is caught by a sign in Berlin this morning, quote, "There is no planet B." And that's the point. We are now it's tragic that the president should be trying to roll back environmental standards that could preserve planet A. And historians will look back and say, wait a minute, just when you were getting these reports from everybody, UN, the scientists, that the end was at hand or something like it, that you could look forward to a globally warmed future, just then we had a president who basically and his party had become sort of servitors of the Grand Oil Party of all times. It's tragic. And you ask what effect it will have. It has to have some kind of effect. And I think this is it makes it incumbent upon the Democratic candidates to make clear to the voters that something like the planet may be on the ballot in 2020. Because Trump denies global warming, he serves the oil companies, we will have more and worse, and the Democrats have simply got to drive that point home to a public that doesn't want to be paralyzed with pessimism, but on the other hand has to be rallied to rise to this moment of planetary challenge.
I'll be hosting that show from here in New York City on Monday at initially going live at 10 a.m. I want to turn now for just a moment in closing the show to a remarkable woman named Mary Martha Corinne Morrison Claiborne Boggs Roberts. You may know her better as Cokie Roberts, the veteran broadcast journalist. She died this week at the age of 75. She was a colleague of mine for years here at NPR, also a mainstay for decades at ABC News. Here she was asserting her passion for truth-telling and for the place of women on NPR's Morning Edition early this year with Steve Inskeep.
The House of Representatives passed the 19th Amendment to the Constitution granting women the right to vote.
No granting. We had the right to vote as American citizens. We didn't have to be granted it by some bunch of guys.
Okay, that we should mention is NPR's own Cokie Roberts correcting the introduction to this story.
No granting. Cokie Roberts, you know, she broke boundaries here at NPR, sort of a founding mother who insisted, you know, on not just an equal, but a primary role for women at the network, a clear-eyed reporter, and somebody who brought women in to center the narrative. Karen Tumulty, just a brief amount of time we have left. You wrote a bit about how she inspired you as well.
She did. When I first came to Washington and was covering The Hill, Cokie, because she came from the institution. Both her parents were members of Congress. She just had this incredible understanding of how Washington worked, how it should work, and she was so generous in sharing that with so many of us who were getting started out. And I just think that her journalism really was marked by this kind of common sense and consistency that we tend to devalue in the, mm-hmm. the era that we are living in now. Mm-hmm.
Cokie Roberts elevated women at NPR. She elevated women in the central role, and she schooled generations of CEOs here at NPR how things should be done. Karen Tumulty, thanks for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Margaret Tolliv of Axios. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
And for On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty, have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.